Whether you're a weekend skier or an Olympic competitor, cross-country skiing is a rich and fulfilling pastime. On this edition of Conversations, ski coach John Estel joins us to talk about cross-country. Let's go skiing in place on this edition of Conversations. Hi, John. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You know, for a lot of people, winter is a time when they put away outdoor trappings and activities and wait for spring, kind of move inside in Fairbanks' colder time. But I know for a lot of people it's almost the opposite, that's the time where people gear up. Since there's a lot of people in our audience who probably aren't skiers, tell me what attracted you to cross-country skiing and why it's an enduring sport for you.
Originally, I started in cross-country skiing because I was a cross-country runner in college, and all of my friends on the cross-country running team were cross-country skiers, and I didn't really like to run outdoors during the winter. So I became a cross-country skier because it offered a way for me to stay in shape for track season and not have to do it on foot. that was 25 years ago. And since then, I guess the thing that most attracts me to the sport is just the fact that I'm able to get outdoors in various environments and enjoy the outdoors, but also just the pleasure of movement. Cross-country skiing is one of the few sports where you're really actively using all the muscles and all the limbs simultaneously. And there's just something about that movement as opposed to a legs-only or arms-only sport or a hand-eye sport or a sport where you're in limited surroundings, such as in swimming, where you just can't go where you want to go. That really appeals to me about it.
Uh-huh. So getting out and about, plus the fluidity of physical movement. And it does seem like it's fluid, rather than if I think of basketball or racquetball or...
Yes, it's a very, very beautiful sport when it's practiced by people who are good at it. When I watch videotapes of myself or when I see people who are just beginning, sometimes it's not quite as beautiful. But when you're lucky enough, as I have been, to watch the best skiers in the world just in training and in competition, it's really beautiful. And it's deceptive because it looks like it's, as with any sport, I guess, when it's done well by those who do it very well, it looks incredibly easy. But it's a very, very difficult sport to master. But it's not that difficult to get to the point where you can really enjoy it.
And for those who, once again, I expose the people to whom we're advertising this sport right now in conversations, is this something anybody can do given fairly basic physical abilities?
I think so. That's one of the things that really appeals to me about the sport is that I really feel like anyone can do it. The younger you start, the better. But you don't have to start young. My father took it up a couple of years ago or three winters ago when he was 82. So, you know, the way he skis and the way I ski are probably a little different, but he really enjoys the sport. And he's 85 now, and if he can enjoy the sport at that age, having just done it for 3 years, I guess about anybody can.
Great. What got him at 82 to say, sure, I can ski?
Well, he'd been a runner in college, and then again in his middle age, he decided he'd take up running again for fitness. And then shortly after I got out of college, he and my mom had moved south and spent a lot of winters down there. So when he got back north in the winter back in New Hampshire, he decided he wanted to do something that enabled him to get out in the winter. And he hadn't, he ran a lot, but once he got to be 80, running was a little harder. So that helped him to avoid running on ice during the winter and worrying about falling down and that sort of thing.
Is cross-country skiing softer in that way? There's not so much...
Definitely. Uh-huh. Definitely. One of the reasons that when I began to compete seriously in cross-country skiing, one of the reasons was that I had been a serious runner, or not very fast, but serious anyway, and I had incurred some injuries in running, some fairly chronic problems, and when I began ski training, the problems disappeared, and I could train far more volume of training for cross-country skiing than I could for running. And the other thing that was great about it was training for cross-country skiing. I was out in the woods, up in the mountains, and off the roads.
I've noticed this on most of the the training films I've watched and the videotapes on basic cross-country skiing is when they talk about dry land training, it's all out in the woods. There's not a road anywhere.
Yes, there are roads because when you roller ski, you have to roller ski on paved roads,
of course,
for the most part.
Right. Yeah.
But that's maybe 40% to 50% of the training. The other half of the training I like roller skiing too, but the other half is what I really love because you can train by going out in the mountains and running or hiking. You can run on trails. There are a number of special exercises and drills you can do that don't occur on pavement or on little limited areas. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's a very, very liberating aspect of the sport, is that you can prepare for it almost anywhere.
Can a person train at any level? I think most people, when they think training, they think, I don't do that. I mean, top-level competitors in whatever the sport is train. But are there levels of training for everybody? And why is it important for cross-country skiing to train?
Well, I wouldn't. I guess training, to me, there's a connotation of a degree of seriousness about the sport where you're really trying to achieve some certain level of performance. And that's usually measured through competition. But on the other hand, what I would call an active lifestyle or a fitness lifestyle is, I think, the different level from training. If you're concerned mostly with your fitness, with your general health, and being able to get out and do what you want to do, when you want to do it year-round, then there are so many things you can do in that lifestyle, and in the winter, I think cross-country skiing is the number one thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You said a moment ago that when you look at a really good skier, it feels like what he or she is doing is very easy to do, very simple to do. I've read that there's really just a few techniques, and it's the mastery of them that is...
Yes. The basic two techniques are skating technique and classic technique. And up until 10 years ago, there was only classic technique. Skating has just come along really since the mid-80s, or since the early 80s. And that was an outgrowth of a combination of factors, from improved grooming with bigger, heavier equipment that made the trail surface much harder, faster skis, fiberglass skis, mm-hmm. better quality of P-Tex on the base.
P-Tex is what?
P-Tex is a polyethylene material that's on the base of skis, alpine skis and cross-country skis. Stronger athletes, better training, and...
So you're telling me skating emerged out of racing.
Skating emerged definitely out of racing. About 15 years ago, a technique called marathon skating was begun, and that was a hybrid between classic technique and skating technique, and you see it very rarely now, although... you can kind of tell who was around when skating began because you'll see those people do it, and I think it's still a very useful technique. Mm-hmm. But that began when people wanted to go very fast, faster than they could go double poling or in other classic techniques, so they would leave one ski in the tracks and skate with the other ski at an angle to the track, like half of a herringbone.
Pushing your ski away
yes.
from yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, you put all your weight on the pushing ski, and then just as you finish your push, you bring your weight back onto the ski that's in the track.
And if somebody wants to image it without being able to see it, of course, it looks very much like you're skating on ice.
With one leg.
With one ski, yeah.
Yeah. Right. So that began in the early 80s. And at that time, it was quite revolutionary. And there was tremendous resistance to it among the traditional homes of cross-country skiing, especially in Scandinavia, Norway in particular. But in 1982, Bill Koch, an American, was the winner of the overall World Cup championship. World Cup title is a season-long title of 10 races. And one of the main reasons he was able to win was that he was much better at marathon skating than just about everybody else. And he had spent hours and hours perfecting it. He's a real sort of Zen master. When he thinks about something, he just pursues it until he's got it to the level that he wants. A couple of years after that, at the very end of the season, the final step was taken, which was in some spring races in Scandinavia, one of the competitors decided, hey, who needs kick wax? And he just decided he wasn't going to put any grip wax at all on his skis, mm-hmm. and he just skated the whole course, a lot of the time with both skis out of the track. So that was really the beginning of full-on skating, and things developed with amazing rapidity over the next couple of seasons. And one of my favorite stories about skating is it was my third year coaching at UAF, 1985. We were in a competition at the University of Vermont, and at that time, for skating uphill, you did what's normally considered a herringbone, where you skate with one leg, pole with one arm. Mm-hmm. And standing beside me on the course was the Mike Gallagher, who was at that time head coach of the U.S. ski team, and he'd just come back from races in Europe, and he said, boy, over in Europe, they're poling with both poles while they skate. And so as the skiers on the UAF team were going up the hill, I started going, pole with both poles. Uh-huh. And so they actually learned a technique during the race. So their second time up the hill, they were using a whole different technique. And that's really how fast the technique was changing.
Fascinating. So in the middle of the race.
In the middle of a race.
Now tell me how, people will be curious, tell me how the introduction of skating and double pole skating affected the speed and the
skating
results.
Speeds are 10 to 12% higher than classic speeds. But what's actually happened a little bit since then is I think skating gets a little faster, and then classic catches up a little, uh-huh. and skating levels off, and then classic levels off, and skating gets a little faster. And
what's happening there? Because it's not a different technique that's affecting
that. No, I'm not quite sure what's happening. It's in any sport where there's a certain level of performance that's the ultimate level, it's only the ultimate level for a short while. And then people respond to that ultimate level by saying, mm-hmm. I can go beyond that. And that's why world records are set in track and field and in swimming and in other sports. A Swedish skier named Gunde Svan, who was World Cup champion maybe six or seven times, I think that was the key to his success. Was he was definitely competing with the other skiers in the race, but I think his real goal was to carry the sport and carry his performance to a level beyond what anybody else was capable of. And if you look at his career, one year he'd win three quarters of the races, and the next year he'd win half the races, and the next year there'd be pretty good competition, and then it's like he'd go home, do his homework, and say, jeepers, everybody's getting too close, or I better figure something out. Then he'd move up a notch and win a whole bunch of races the next year.
Interesting. I wonder if almost any individual competitive sport is like that. If you think about tennis, there are players who fall off a bit and then come back. And
I think so, because it's a very natural thing. In 1972, I think, for the Olympic marathon, the AAU, which was the governing body at that time, didn't want to pay too much money to bring runners into the Olympic marathon. So they said, if you run under two hours and 20 minutes or 2 hours and 19 minutes or something like that, we'll pay your airfare and your room and board. Mm. And at that time, four or five Americans a year did that. I think 198 American men did that in the next 12 months. And so it's very natural. If you establish a goal, sooner or later somebody's going to figure out how to surpass it.
Sure.
And you know, eventually the world record time for the 100-meter dash will be 0-0, but not for a while.
Not for a while. John Estill is our guest on this edition of Conversations. We're taking a look at cross-country skiing at all sorts of levels, for beginners, people who are interested in just picking up something new to do during the winter, and for those who are at the highest levels of competition. John has kind of been at all these levels. As he said, he started out as a cross-country runner and decided, given his body, that he would take up skiing instead, actually using skiing for some winter training for his running while he was running. John was the UAF ski coach in Fairbanks from 1982 to 1990. He's now the assistant coach at UAF. In between, he went off and became the head cross-country coach for the United States Olympic team, traveling and working with that Olympic team for 3 years. And his last year, he spent at the U.S. Olympic Education Center at Marquette, Michigan, which is Northern Michigan University, where they have an emphasis on seven Olympic all-winter sports, right?
Yes.
Yeah. John Estill, our guest on this edition of Conversations. Let's back up a little bit from competition and go back to the armchair skier or the early skier. Talk to me about the the relative use of arms and legs, of upper body and lower body in skiing. They do really different things, but complementary things. Or seem to.
Actually, they do the same thing. They're both pushing you down the track. The relative contribution in terms of propulsion, depending on whose tests you read, is that the upper body contributes somewhere between 30% and 50% to the forward propulsion, and the lower body contributes 50% to 70%. But those figures vary over the years as different things are emphasized in training. If it's static at one level for a few years, then what will happen is that somebody will figure out a way to use the underutilized portion a little more, and then the ratios will change for a few years, I think. But generally, what you're trying to do is, if the track's running that way, you're trying to head in that direction as fast as you can. And the more effectively you can utilize the arms and the legs to propel you in that direction, the more you're going to enjoy the sport, whether you're trying to do it for recreation or for competition.
And is that how essentially the different stroking has evolved? It's more efficient to use a diagonal stride across a meadow and a herringbone up a hill and
yes.
snowplow down a hill. And
the best skiers and the people, I think, who enjoy skiing the most at any level are very, very good at reading terrain and reading speed. And they know that at a certain speed or in a certain type of terrain, there's a certain form of technique that's best. As you said, on a steep uphill, you herringbone.
Mm-hmm. And for people who don't know what that is, the tails of the skis are together and the tips
just
are facing out.
Yes.
Like on a jacket, if that's how
yeah.
you see it.
It looks just like a herringbone.
Yeah.
If you've ever seen a herringbone pattern. Mm-hmm. And actually, it looks probably more like a herringbone pattern in clothing, because the tails of the skis are slightly offset.
I see.
In this manner.
All right. Are you also, when you're, for example, using that herringbone, are you putting the body center and the body weight on the inner edge of the ski, and on different kinds of techniques, is the weight on different edges of the ski?
In herringboning, you have to have your weight on the inside edge, otherwise you just slide right back down the hill. Mm-hmm. In classic technique in general, if you're going straight ahead, if you're not making a corner, you want the weight as flat on the ski as possible. You want it equally distributed fore and aft, left and right, so that the ski is flat, because a ski that is flat relative to the track will run much faster than a ski that's on edge. There's less pressure, and it's just the mm-hmm. equal distribution of pressure makes it run better. In skating, it's quite different, because if you don't put your weight on your edge at some point, you don't go anywhere. By the same token, if you don't ride a flat ski when you're not trying to push, then you don't go anywhere either. Mm-hmm. So in skating, it's much more a situation where you start out with your weight centered over the ski that you're gliding on, all your weight on one ski, and it's a flat ski, you're riding a flat ski. Then as you begin to push, you sink a little, compress a little, and the ski goes on its edge as your weight is moving to the other side, and then you begin to push. And it's the people who can time that shift and that push best who ski the best.
Uh-huh. Are the best skiers the best in technique? Is that absolutely true?
At the yeah. Olympic level, the best skiers generally don't have too many problems with technique. But I think there are very few skiers, even at the Olympic level, who have what you would call picture book technique. If you take the top 10 skiers in one event, and you take a little bit of this from this guy and a little bit of this mm-hmm. from this woman, show it, if you splice them all together and say, if you want to double pole, you should do it the way that this person does it.
Uh-huh. But
even though this person won a gold medal, don't do it like he does it.
Uh-huh.
But there are very, very few people, I think most coaches would agree, whose technique is just flawless from top to bottom.
And part of this is the idiosyncratic nature of competition.
Yes, mm-hmm. and it's the people at the very highest level, and I don't mean to talk all the time about the highest level, but
right.
the people who win medals are incredibly gifted physically. I mean, they chose their parents perfectly. And so they can get away with mistakes that I couldn't get away with. If I if I were ever to try to compete at a high level again, I have to really concentrate on my technique and be doing everything just right, because I don't have the luxury of the, you know, the extra muscle mass or the high oxygen uptake or whatever that the medalists do. Mm-hmm. So especially for people who aren't as gifted physically as Olympic medalists, which is 99.99% of us, it's very important to work on technique. You don't have to have perfect technique to enjoy the sport well, but you really need to think about what your rhythm is and how you ride the skis and the timing of your movements within your cycle.
Do you suggest that people take the parts of a stroke apart to practice them? Work only with legs, work only with poles? How would you advise someone practice technique?
My advice to somebody who's starting the sport or somebody who has been in the sport only for a short while and wants to get better at it is to find someone to give them lessons. Uh-huh. Because it's a complex enough sport. In many ways it's very simple, but the techniques are complex enough so that it's important that you understand correctly what you're trying to accomplish within a given technique. And it's very difficult to do that, I think, without some sort of coaching or outside opinion, mainly because cross-country skiing in most of the U.S., and Alaska is somewhat of an exception to this, but in most of the U.S., cross-country skiing is not a mainstream sport. It's not a sport that people grow up with an image of in their mind, where in Norway, Sweden, Finland, a young child sees people cross-country skiing from the time he's old enough to open his or her eyes. And so with that image in their minds and watching Olympic races, watching World Cup races all the time, that child can go out, put skis on, and go, I know what to do. This is easy, you know. This so-and-so does this. And so it's very easy for them. Where in the U.S., someone who really likes skiing may never have seen it on TV, even though they've been skiing for 20 years. And I think that person, if they want to get better at the sport, is really well served by finding someone who's good and taking some lessons and really learning what it is they're trying to accomplish.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. Talking about imaging, how much of skiing is mental? They talk about, say, basketball, that you mm-hmm. put your mind on the hoop, put your mental hands on the ball as much as your physical hands.
There's a lot of ways you can look at that. I mean, I think Yogi Berra said about baseball, it's 90% physical and the other half mental.
Yeah.
And that's really a pretty good way to explain it, because in skiing, the first 90% has got to be the physical preparation and having the physical tools. And so at the highest levels, everybody's got about the same tools and the same preparation. So then it becomes who wants it the most, who's willing to push the hardest, who's willing to suffer the most or whatever. And that, I think, is what really determines it. And it's not just a matter of, well, I can suffer more than this other guy, although it does come down to that sometimes. But it's more a matter of, I think, the people who get the best performance are people who have a very clear picture of what they want to accomplish in a competition. They want to ski. They can visualize every single meter of the course and how they're going to ski it and how they're going to ski it faster than anybody else. Think, okay, here's a 50-meter section. There are this sort of corners, this sort of terrain. If I do this and this and this, I'll gain half a second here. So for the...
Half a second?
1980 Olympic 15-kilometer race was decided by a hundredth of a second. And after that, they decided they'd only timed a tenth, because a hundredth of a second over 15 kilometers at that speed is this much.
It's 3 inches, two
yeah,
and a half
three
inches.
Or four centimeters, I think, was what it was.
Wow.
So... yeah, it's if you can see how you want to ski and actually ski that way, then that's very important. But also it comes down, at the end of a race, when things are close, that's when it comes down to who wants it the most. And in Gunde Svan's last season, it was kind of a passing of the torch in the 15-kilometer race. He had won the gold medal in the first race, and that was his last big individual gold medal. And in the 15-kilometer, he was defeated for the gold medal by Bjørn Dahle, who has since 91 and 92 has been the main man in cross-country skiing in the men's side of the sport. And at that race, Gunda and Dahle were very, very close. And afterward, in an interview, Gunda said, I had a difficult time getting motivated. I'd won, you know, 9 or 11 or whatever Olympic gold medals. I'd won 7 World Cups. Mm-hmm. And it got down to the final half a kilometer, and he really wanted that race. He hadn't won his gold medals yet. He wanted that race much more than I did. And I think Gunda's recognition of that was part of the reason he retired at the end of the season, was if you can't get motivated to win a gold medal, then...
I think we're done, yeah. Right? Sure. Huh. What do you keep your mind on when you're skiing? Different things for different purposes?
Mostly, I try to think about technique. Uh-huh. And part of that is that I've skied classic for my whole life, my whole skiing life, and I've skated only really for the last 10 years. But in the last 2 or 3 years, I've never been as good a skater as I wanted to be. So in the last 2 or 3 years, I have really tried to think a lot about technique, how to optimize technique. There were some aspects of skating technique that I really wasn't very good at all, others that I was pretty good at. And so I found myself using the forms that I was good at in areas where I maybe should have been using a different form. So I've really spent quite a lot of time thinking about technique. But also, a lot of times I just go out there to clear my mind and look around at the trees and check out the moose when I see the moose out there and get views of the mountains.
Yeah. Boy, it's a multi-purpose sport, isn't it?
Very much so.
This is John Estel with us on this edition of Conversations. We've turned our attention to cross-country skiing, things to do both it sounds like to enhance the inner life as well as the outer life on, I mean, it's nice, cross-country skiing on this edition of Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. With us today is cross-country coach and longtime competitor John Estel. The level at which John competed, he was among the top 15 in the United States for about 3 years of his peak competition, and he has trained the top skiers in the United States for about 3 years as well. John is currently assistant coach here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. You know, John, you were talking about Gunda Svan just before the end of that final race, feeling like he didn't have that competitive hunger, that edge. He was out of steam in at least in that level. Talk to me about kind of other aspects of mental preparation, of mental toughness. You were talking about imaging before. Here's the one I'm interested in now. What happens? How do you sort out at the very beginning of the race, just before you get started, all those nerves that, you know, where the energy is just everywhere?
One thing I tell most of the skiers that I work with is that it's very important to have a plan before the race. And normally, if I'm working with a high school skier or a college skier, I jokingly refer to it as their homework, and I tell them a couple of days before the race to sit down with a pencil and a piece of paper, or sit down in their front of their computer if they want to do it on a word processor, and make a written plan for the competition. And that would consist of how they want to ski various sections of the course, how they want to feel right at the start, how they want to feel after a kilometer, how they want to feel halfway through, how they want to feel a kilometer from the finish, what they think is the crucial section of the course for them, if it's the middle third or maybe the last kilometer, which is the most important for them to be successful. I ask them to see themselves skiing particular sections of the course and write down what technique they want to use over a certain section. And that's a that's a very, very important part of it. And that's given that somebody has the ability to stand in the starting gate with the right, what they call, arousal level or an optimal functioning level where they're not too nervous but they're not quite comatose either. And that level differs for everybody. If someone has trouble reaching that proper
state that you want to be in when the race begins, then you might have to do a few other things. One skier that, or actually this was for a running race, this past year I was working with a runner, and I suggested to her, she'd sometimes gotten nervous for big races, and I said, well, when I see you run, I always see that you've got a big smile on your face, that you really enjoy running, that that you're responding to the competition of people around you, and you have that bring out the best in you. And so knowing that her father or mom did a lot of videotaping of her during the races, I said, why don't you take some of those tapes out and look at them and just see how much you enjoy racing? And if you can see yourself enjoying it from the outside, then when you stand at that starting line, you ought to be really ready to have a good time, because it's the other athletes in the race who bring out the best in you. It's not that, that they're there to beat you. It's they're there so that you can respond to their challenge. And that is an outward-directed way of looking at it, and it shouldn't be just outwardly directed. But in this case, I was thinking that if the athlete wasn't getting into just the right state before the race, it was probably from outward factors rather than inward factors. And I think that approach in combination with a good race plan is a very successful way to do your best in a competition.
Both of those techniques or tools take someone out of the emotion. You put yourself into intellect by planning, and you put yourself into pleasure, I suppose. Is that what you're doing with the other?
Well, it was more a lot of people get nervous before competitions, too nervous. That's probably more common than not nervous enough. And I think in most cases it's because their fear is a problem. And when fear is a problem, you're just not able to be yourself and to do the things that you're capable of. So if you can somehow look at the situation, whether it's rationally or emotionally or whatever works for you, and eliminate the fear from it, then it's a much less threatening situation. And then you can deal with it, and you can make the decisions, the good decisions that help you cope with the race situation in the best way. So in that situation, it wasn't so much pleasure, I would say. It was more look at the race. Look at yourself in the race. It's not a threat. You enjoy it. So get out there and enjoy it.
Yeah. Take your mind off this thing, because that thing's not important.
Right.
Right. Right. This is John Estill with us on Conversations. I listened to an interview recently with Greg Louganis, who's the best diver the world has ever known, at least by reputation. And he was saying that he always had a very low self-esteem. He never figured that he was good for anything except diving, which meant that if he had a bad dive day, a bad workout, he wasn't good for anything. Have you run into top-level, world-class skiers who are dealing with problems of that complication and magnitude?
That's actually amazingly common at all levels of sport, but even at the very highest levels, it's more common than you'd think. And I have found from 15 years of experience that it's actually more common with female athletes than with male athletes, and I don't really know why that is. But and that's not to say that it never occurs in male athletes, because it certainly does. But it's actually quite common. And one of the things that I have, with the athletes I've worked closely with, one thing that I always try to emphasize with them is that what kind of person you are doesn't depend on what kind of race you just had. If you just won a race, doesn't mean you're a better person. If you just finished dead last, doesn't mean you're a worse person. And as simple and as trite as that sounds, it's something that most athletes don't think about very often. And especially before big competitions, say an athlete is in an international competition overseas for the first time, be it the Junior World Championships or the Olympics or World Championships, or even for a high school athlete being in a state championships or something like that. They develop pretty much out of the blue sky a whole set of expectations, put huge pressure on themselves. Generally, they expect a performance that exceeds anything they've done before, and there's no basis in fact on which to base those expectations. So they need to be, I've found that they need to be reassured that even if they fall down in the mud and get passed by everybody in the field and come in minutes behind, that after the race their friends are still their friends and their parents still love them, and the people who are important to them, their opinion hasn't changed. And that's one way, especially with younger athletes, that is, I think that's a very good way to take pressure off. Now, that's not to say that no one should ever feel pressure, because a great number of athletes respond very well to pressure. Some respond to tremendous pressure very well, although that's not a system that I would use, an approach that I would use with many athletes. But in general, I think it's very important that the athlete have his or her performance in perspective and what that performance means. And if a diver who is as spectacularly good as Greg Louganis can have a negative self-image after a bad performance, then you know that it can happen to anybody. And it's a very, very common problem.
Mm. I suppose part of it's just that you're in that rarefied air. You're way up there.
Well, it's a problem at every level. I've dealt with athletes at the Olympics who, an athlete, say, who was our best skier and who, like, miles ahead of our second best skier in an Olympics, and she was really in doubt that we were going to pick her to be on the relay team where we pick our four best skiers. And I never would have thought that there could be any question in this athlete's mind but that she would be on the team. But in her mind, that even though she'd beaten everybody else on the team almost every single race for about 3 years, she was unsure of that. So you never know.
Yeah, it's interesting how complex an animal the human being is, isn't it?
It's amazing.
By cross-country skiing today on this edition of Conversations, it's also a fairly complex mental universe. Let's take ourselves outside and back to other levels of skiing for a few minutes. I suppose what I want to talk to you about is cold. We have from mild cold to some of the most extreme cold in the world around here. Talk to me about how a skier, when do you stop skiing, I suppose, that's a question, or do you ever? And how does a skier take him or herself out differently to deal with the elements?
I have always stopped skiing or stopped having training with the teams at 20 below Fahrenheit, which is about 30 below Celsius. And the reason for that is that usually at that temperature, or sometimes even at temperatures warmer than that, the snow gets so slow that it ceases to become skiing, in that you don't glide, or you glide very, very little, and you might as well just put your skis up and run.
Now tell me, I don't understand that part about the snow gets slow.
Well, snow isn't just snow. If you had 3 or 4 hours, I could bring in some wax technicians or snow scientists who could lecture at length on the different consistencies of snow. When snow gets very cold, it gets very, very dry, and the crystals become very, very sharp. So sharp that they really interact in a unproductive way with the base material, with this PTEX base, polyethylene base. It's a very aggressive interaction, the net effect of which is the skis go slow or don't go at all. At warmer temperatures, up to around freezing, generally the skis get faster. And then again, when you get really wet snow at above freezing, 40 or 50 Fahrenheit or 5 to 10 degrees Celsius, you get a situation where it gets slow again, generally speaking.
But that's a nice range from 20 below to freezing.
Oh, yeah. And even when the skiing is, even when the snow is slow, it's not that bad. But you can ski at 40 below if you want to as well. And when people do backcountry trips in the midwinter in Alaska, people do the Iditarod sport, Iditarod ski. it's very common to ski at 40 below, and it's not unsafe. It's just if you're out training to race or something, then I think at that temperature you may be better off going for a foot run.
Mm-hmm.
As far as is it safe at that temperature, I think it's perfectly safe as long as you're prepared for it and you have the right clothing and you know what you should do and what you shouldn't do. I've attended some seminars for Olympic coaches, one of which dealt with environmental medicine, and the main lecturer on that subject actually had been in Fairbanks working at Wainwright doing research for the Army's Environmental Medicine Lab. And his basic premise, and I actually spent some time talking to him after the lectures to really get a feel for it, is that as long as you're dressed properly, as long as you have enough clothes on, and as long as you take adequate precautions, that you can be safe at just about any cold temperature. But, you can never take enough clothes off when it's too warm. But definitely when you get down to 20, 30, 40 below Fahrenheit, you have to, you have to dress very, very warmly. You want to make sure that your hands and feet and head are adequately protected. And if you feel your fingers or your toes getting cold, then by all means, either warm them up or get inside immediately.
Mm-hmm. Have you had frostbite problems?
Luckily, I have never really had any problems, which I just, in that respect, I guess I chose my parents well. I have really, really good circulation in my hands and feet.
Mm-hmm.
But I know people who have had some problems with frostbite. When we would train in very cold days, I would usually ask the team to ski in groups of two or three and have them check one another's noses and cheeks and everything and earlobes on a regular basis if they weren't covered, just to make sure that people weren't getting any little frost nip. And if you get a little superficial nip and warm it right up, it's really not a problem. It's when you get the real deep stuff in your fingers or toes, that can be a problem. And it is possible to do that skiing. I don't want to minimize the danger at all. Plenty of people have had bad frostbite in their hands and feet just from being out skiing for an hour or two on a very cold day.
Huh. How about nutritionally? How do you get ready to go ski? It's a this is an instance where the body wants carbohydrates to expend the energy over a period of time, right?
Yes, carbohydrates have to be the main portion of the diet for a serious skier, or someone who's who just has an active lifestyle where they train an hour and a half a day all year round, whether it's skiing or whatever. And generally speaking, the good carbohydrates, good bread, whole grain stuff, rice, potatoes, that sort of thing, pasta, that's all good stuff. When in October, November, skiers are doing huge volumes of training. They're skiing 50 to 100 kilometers a day. And it's amazing how much food they eat, because skiing burns at competition speeds, you're burning maybe 1,500 calories an hour. So in training, maybe 1,200. But if you train 6 or 7 hours a day, you're up around 7,000 or 8,000 calories plus the 2,000 that it takes to grow hair and toenails. And so when you start trying to take in 8 or 10,000 calories on a regular basis, you can't do that with just good food. You got to eat some junk. And it's amazing to watch people just when they're training at that level, watching them pound down cookies and cakes and pies and everything just for more fuel.
Phew, something else. How about liquids?
You need to be hydrated to perform well, I think, just in everyday life. In skiing, it's very important. Ideally, you should train with a water bottle of some sort. There are little fanny packs that you can travel with that have water bottles in them. And ingest about 250 milliliters or 4 ounces of water every 15 to 20 minutes while you're training. That's a pretty basic amount. at the same time, it's good to drink a little before you begin your workout or your race, and it's good to start drinking immediately after. Another thing that's good to do immediately after training, especially if you've done a longer workout, is to consume carbohydrates. And it's I'm sure entertaining for people who aren't familiar with the amount of training that the top athletes do. When we would finish a workout, the skiers come in, you know, rip off their wet clothes, put on their dry clothes, start drinking, and just about everybody will pull out a bag of bagels or just a loaf of bread and start eating just plain bread or bagels or whatever to replenish, because it's the calories that you replace, the calories you replace in the first hour or two after a hard or long training session do the most to replenish your stores.
Huh, not after a rest. So you're skiing or working on the skiing process actively even after you're off the boards.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Huh. This is John Estill. We're talking about cross-country skiing. A little more information about John. His bachelor's degree was in American history from Middlebury in Middlebury, Vermont. At that time, he was a runner. He joined cross country at Middlebury and went into serious competition about 3 years out of college. He was about 24 when he started in serious competition, which is an interesting thing to me because you're a full-grown man with a completed body by that time. And rather than, you know, with tennis and some other sports, we see kids going in at 3 and 4 and 5 years old. So this is in some ways a mature sport as well as a kid's sport.
It is, but it's still best to start as young as possible. I've always been at somewhat of a disadvantage just because, though I grew up alpine skiing, I can't ever remember not alpine skiing, but alpine skis are different enough from cross-country skis so that because I started at 18 years old or 19 years old, I'm just not at home on the skis like someone who begins when they're 4 or 5 or 6 years old or even 12 or 14 years old. They would be much more at home on the skis. So when it comes time to go down a hill under bad conditions or making transitions from one technique to another or riding a ski, they can do so much more automatically and with much less thought about it than can I.
Tell me if there are parents with budding skiers in our audience today. Is there a good training program available in Fairbanks?
Right now, in the last 4 or 5 years, I think within the Nordic Ski Club of Fairbanks, there's begun a junior Nordic league, and it's been organized by Karin Gillis, who used to ski at the university. She was on the team the first year I was coaching her. She's from Sweden originally, and she grew up as a cross-country skier. And she has begun this program, and I think now there are over 100 young children in it, and it's, I think, the youngest skiers in it are only 4 or 5 years old, and it goes up to 13 or 14 years of age, either through sixth grade or through junior high. And that's an excellent way to get your children involved in the sport because, number one, it's in a group situation, so they're not just out there slogging around the trail with you or by themselves. They've got friends to play games with. It's a very low-key program. It's oriented mostly toward learning how to ski reasonably well and having fun, playing games, that sort of thing. The coaches who are in the program all have a little bit of training anyway in how to run the program. And so your child is supervised and organized, and it seems to me like it's really fun. It's a couple of nights a week, and I've been up there several times just this winter when the Junior Nordic League has come there, and that's it really looks like a fun thing. But also a number of the elementary schools have programs. I know Weller, Joy, Nordale, Ladd, I know they've all had programs up at Birch Hill this year at least once a week. And both junior highs in town, both Ryan and Tanana, have programs. And, of course, all of the high schools, West Valley, Lathrop, and North Pole, all have programs too.
How about for older folks?
I think that the Borough Parks and Rec program operates a seniors learn to ski program. I don't know the details of that, and I may be mistaken, but I've heard that is the case. And it's like I said, it's never too old to start. My dad picked it up when he was 82, and it's a great way to get outdoors. For people in their 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s who want to do it, like I said, get a lesson. Find somebody who's an instructor and call him up and ask to go out for a couple of lessons just so they can show you what's involved with the sport, or have, if you have a friend who's been doing it for a long time and who's pretty good at it, maybe have them go out and just get you started on snow, on skis, and then after you're a little bit familiar with it, then maybe get some lessons at that point.
Is this a sport that needs thousands of dollars of equipment? And
no, it's more expensive than it was. When I started, you could get a complete outfit for under $100, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. Now, I would say most of the way to start is just to get a package at a local sport shop. I think you can get those for the $300 range or $400 range, something like that.
A package is boots, skis,
skis, poles, bindings. Mm-hmm. At the same time, if you know someone who has equipment, or if you look for used equipment, there are usually people who are trying to upgrade or getting rid of their old equipment. They've bought new stuff and want to sell their old. So if you know how to get in touch with the Nordic Ski Club of Fairbanks and put an ad or a notice in their newsletter, or you could put an ad or a notice up at a local sports shop or up at the Birch Hill warming hut, and you might get a call if you just say, I'm a beginner looking for equipment, and so on. And that's generally the least expensive way to go, and you can get some real good equipment that way.
Okay. We're talking with John Estel, another person to talk to about skiing, and our subject is cross-country skiing. I mentioned earlier that John was the head coach for the United States Olympic team from 1990 through 1993. 91 and 93 were not Olympic years. He was the head coach for the World Championships, which are the alternate year competitions. And in 1992, he was the head coach for the Olympics held in Albertville. And tell me, what was in Les Saisies?
The cross-country ski competitions and biathlon competitions were held in Les Saisies.
Okay, there were 17 Americans on the team that year, 9 men and 8 women. There's usually an imbalance between women and men. Is this just a process of catching up?
At the national team level, it's usually pretty close numbers. Normally, the national team for men and the national team for women, world championship team or world championship groups, World Cup groups, are generally about equal in number in our country. But when you actually get to the Olympics or the world championships, generally the men's field is somewhere around 180 to 110, somewhere in that range, and the women's field will normally be 40 to 60. And if you look at competition from, say, the high school level through college level, national level, that's a fairly consistent ratio, is about 3-2 or 2-1. There are just more men competing than women.
Mm-hmm. I want to give the time we have left to the subject of endurance. Unless I'm wrong, it seems to me that this is, besides technique, the core of cross-country skiing, core.
To an extent, but especially in the last 4 or 5 years, since I had the opportunity to watch a lot of international competitions at the very, very highest levels, I've become more and more an advocate of strength and power, and that it's very necessary to develop those qualities for competition anyway. You have to develop those qualities almost first and then be able to sustain those qualities through endurance training, because the very best skiers are incredibly strong. You can't believe how strong they are until you watch them go up a hill taking just huge, huge steps. And it's not just their legs, it's their whole body is very, very strong. So I've really pushed in the athletes that I've been working with, whether it's skiing or running or whatever, that let's develop strength and then let's figure out how to sustain the application of that strength or that power over the entire duration of the competition. And that, to me, that's the key. I think in America, especially in running, but also in cross-country skiing, people think, I want to run a 10-kilometer race, 6 miles. So I need to be able to run 10 miles so I can run 6. I'll develop endurance for it. And they train at a speed that's considerably less than their competition speed. And yes, they can cover 6 miles, no problem. But they don't have the strength and they aren't able to apply the power that they need to do so that for that entire distance, whether it's running or skiing or whatever, they have the stride length and the stride rate that they want. And it's stride length times stride rate that determines how fast you go. If every stride is reasonably long, you don't want it too long, but you want it long enough, and if they occur frequently enough, then you go fast. And if they don't occur frequently enough, or if they're short because you just can't push hard enough with your arms or your legs, then you don't go fast. And one problem that our skiers have had at all levels, especially at the international level when we haven't had good results, is that our skiers simply weren't as strong as the competition. And it's when you see the best skiers in the world, they are very well muscled. Women, the men, everybody, they are built quite differently. And if you look at runners, especially middle distance track runners, they're built quite differently from how a lot of our runners are. The typical American runner is pretty much a beanpole. And the European runners aren't necessarily fat. They're not fat, but they're definitely stronger in many areas of their body than our skiers are, or our runners are. And so when it comes time, when push comes to shove, and sometimes literally push does come to shove, it's our athletes who are shoved, and they're off the track. And that happened to a number of our women runners in the middle distances in the last Olympics. In Europe, track's a contact sport. And when somebody pushes you or elbows you, you're just supposed to push your elbow right back. And our runners were a little lighter and a little weaker, I think. And they ended up on the outside or at the back of the pack and didn't do their best because they weren't physically prepared. And the same thing with a lot of our skiers. They'll start up the hill with somebody from another country, and halfway up the hill, the other person's still taking the same length stride they were at the bottom, and our skier hasn't been able to sustain that.
Is this going to change? You talk about individuals pushing ahead year by year.
Well,
or are we just behind on this?
Well, I hope it changes, but the way it will change is through education of coaches and athletes. And I think it's going to take a huge change in the mindset or the mentality of most American coaches and athletes to start thinking of endurance sports in terms of strength and power. And when athletes begin to train for strength and power first, or with equal emphasis on those facets as on endurance, then I think it will change. But I don't know when that'll happen.
Interesting. Who's the best country skier in the world? I mean, which country has the best skiers in the world these days?
Well, since from the mid-'80s to the early 90s, Sweden had the best men's team by far, and the Russians, the Soviets at that time, now the Russians, had the best women's team most years, although they'd be occasionally challenged by the Norwegians. Since 91 and 90, beginning in 92, the Norwegian men have pretty much had a lock on things, although last year at the Olympics it was really a great day for the sport when the Italian men's relay team beat the Norwegians. It was a huge upset. There were 120,000 people there to watch. 2.5% of the population of Norway was there to watch in person. And so that was great, not because I like to see the Norwegians get beat, but it's just very healthy for the sport to see someone else come in like that. And the Italians have two or three very good women skiers too, but the Russian women are just unbelievably strong. They've had six skiers in the top eight, sometimes six in the top six, in almost every World Cup race this year. And their skiers, their women skiers, are better than their men right now. Their men, there have been times when their men have been the best in the world, but they haven't been lately. Their women are just so strong, though, and a friend of mine who's a Russian coach says the reason the women are stronger than the men is the women train more than the men. The Russian women, he feels, train more and train harder than the Russian men. And when you see them in races, you don't doubt it. They are just amazing.
I know you're happy at this level of coaching because you've said you are. Do you miss aspects of that level?
One of the things I really enjoyed about coaching at the national team level was watching the races. I think in a lot of ways at heart, maybe I'm as much a fan as anything. And so being able to be there right beside the trail and watch Olympic medalists go by and watch our skiers go by was just a tremendous thrill for me. But There's a lot of travel. I was traveling about 8 out of 12 months a year on the road away from home. There's a lot of pressure at that level. And although I really enjoyed it, learned a lot, I've been there, seen that, done that. Uh-huh. And what I think the biggest pleasure I get out of coaching is teaching. And for me, it's the best level for doing a lot of teaching is at the high school and college level, junior level. And so that's the aspect that I really enjoy right now. And I get probably more pleasure from giving somebody an instruction in technique or an instruction in how to prepare for a race and seeing them actually use that and profit from it than I would from working with a mature athlete at the Olympic level and seeing them win a medal. I mean, it's a tremendous thrill when the medal comes, but I feel a lot more a part of it when I see somebody actually adopt something that's come along in training and the preparation.
Well, John, thanks very much for an interesting hour.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, this has been John Estill. He's currently the assistant coach at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the assistant ski coach. He's also working on a second bachelor's, this BS in computer science here at the university. John teaches and works with Fairbanks master skiers, both in the summertime, but for interim training and in the winter. You've been listening to Conversations on this edition, Cross Country Skiing. I'm Susan McGinnis. I hope you join us again next week. This week, three report cards were issued to every adult living in America today. Every one gave us failing or near-failing grades. The courses we've taken and failed, all were related to the way we care for and educate this nation's children. The Children's Defense Fund gave us straight Fs and charged us with neglecting and mistreating the children under our care. The National Urban League called for a nationwide urban Marshall Plan, saying that without a massive infusion of economic aid, similar to what we gave Europe after World War II, we will continue to fail our urban children, leaving them and this nation ill-prepared for international market competition in the 21st century. The National Assessment of Educational Progress is a congressionally mandated project, the only nationally representative ongoing gauge of student literacy. Its findings? Not good. In presenting the project's national report card, Education Secretary Laurel Cavazos said, "As a nation, we should be appalled that we have placed our children in such jeopardy." I'm Susan McGinnis for KUAC-FM. Today, on Sunday at noon, we ask what has become an enduring question in our society.